Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. Thank you for joining NBN. In his fascinating and riveting new book, Soundtrack to a Movement, African-American Islam, Jazz, and Black Internationalism, historian Richard Brent Turner tells a moving, though rarely discussed narrative of the intersection and cross-pollination between jazz and African-American Islam from the 1940s to the 1970s. How did Islam and conversion to Islam inform the lives, careers, and musical productions of prominent jazz musicians in this period? And how did jazz spaces and culture provide the fodder for important African-American Muslim movements and figures such as the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X? Turner addresses these and other questions with profound historical depth and analytical ingenuity. Over the course of this book, the reader learns about such enormously interesting themes as the landscape of African-American politics during the interwar period and beyond in major East Coast cities, especially Boston, the intimate relationship between jazz and the Ahmadiyya, the relationship between John Coltrane and Malcolm X, and the encounter of jazz with Black internationalism. This lucidly written book will also animate great discussions in the classroom. Here is my conversation with Professor Richard Brent Turner. Richard, welcome to the New Books Network. Absolute pleasure to host you on the New Books Network to talk about this fantastic and phenomenal new book, Soundtrack to a Movement. And it's really an incredible new book that talks about a topic that is so fascinating, yet we don't know much about, but now we do, thanks to your great book. And as I was saying, you know, before we went on air, that in some ways this book is in a very welcome addition to your classic by now, Islam and the African American Experience, that connects some of those themes to very new theaters and arenas. So really excited about this conversation. Richard, our first question on the New Books Network, it's a convention, is always biographical. So if I could ask you the question of, A, how did you become interested in this topic? How did you become a scholar, first of all, a historian? And what led you to become interested in this particular topic that's the focus of this new book?
Well, you know, my road to becoming a scholar started at Boston University in the 1970s. I was an undergraduate student there. And I had access at Boston University to a lot of undergraduate courses in African-American studies in various disciplines. And I guess it was in my junior year when I decided to switch from sociology to religion as my major. And at the same time, when I became very interested in majoring in religion, I also became fascinated with the jazz saxophonist, John Coltrane. I just begun listening to his music, and really, I just was enchanted by the sound of his music, and And actually, during my senior year, I had some very, very good teachers who were encouraging me to possibly think about going on to graduate school and getting a PhD. But one of them had asked for a research paper to read. So I've been doing a lot of research on John Coltrane, and I had written a paper, an autobiography of John Coltrane's life. You know, it's an undergraduate paper that I think I have submitted for a course that I was sent to Harvard University to take on African-American music, because Boston University had a lot of courses in African-American studies, but they didn't have anything on African-American music. So I, you know, gave that paper on John Coltrane's autobiography to my teacher in African-American literature. And he was really pleased by the paper. He said he believed that this was a paper that was worthy of publication and that I should send it to Ann Southern, who was the editor of the Black Perspectives in Music, a peer-reviewed journal. And I was very surprised that within a couple of months, I received a letter from her saying that she wanted to publish the paper on John Coltrane in the Black Perspective in Music. So that was kind of the beginning of my, my interest in jazz as a scholar, and also my interest in religion. And then when I graduated from BU, I went on to do a master's degree in African American studies. And that was a wonderful program, one of the few, master's degrees in African American studies in the United States in the late 1970s. And at the same time, I was thinking about going on for a PhD. Originally, I thought that I would like to do a PhD in ethnomusicology, because I still have this passionate interest in the life and the music of John Coltrane. And, from where I grew up on the East Coast, I saw that the best ethnomusicology program was at Wesleyan University. However, when I contacted Wesleyan, they were pleased enough with my, my academic background for admission, but they mentioned that I would have to do an audition on a musical instrument and have mastered a musical instrument in order to get into their PhD program in ethnomusicology. So that actually led me for a couple of years. Actually while I was doing my work, master's degree in African American studies. And after that, I worked for a couple of years as a high school teacher in the Boston Public Schools. But at the same time, I was, taking, classes and reading music at a community center in Boston. So I pretty quickly learned how to read music. And then for about a year and a half, I was studying the saxophone on Saturday afternoons with a jazz teacher at the New England Conservatory of Music. But, I had a lot of things going on in my life, a lot of interesting hobbies. I was working full-time as a public school teacher. I was interested in athletics, playing in tennis tournaments. And after a couple of years, although I loved the saxophone, I never gave the saxophone the amount of time that, that you really need to give it on a daily basis to develop that type of competence on the saxophone, which would have gained me admission in Wesleyan's ethnomusicology program. So by about 1980, I decided to apply to PhD programs in religion. And you know, and I did get into the PhD program in religion at Princeton University. And there, I think I got some of the background that eventually gave me the intellectual skills to write soundtrack to a movement many, many years later, because part of my PhD program was in the anthropology department at Princeton, where I studied African religions. So I think that, you know, the background in African religions and the African diaspora that I got as a grad student certainly, you know, helped me to write soundtrack to a movement. However, my main area was African-American religions. And, you know, I was very lucky during my second year, actually it was my third year in that PhD program, that Albert Rabiteau, a very important scholar in the field of African-American religion, who had written a groundbreaking book, Slave Religion. He came to Princeton, and he's the person who directed my PhD dissertation. You know, because up to that time, one of my mentors was John Wilson, and he primarily did mainstream American Protestantism. So I had a lot of background in that, but until Rabiteau came on board, I didn't have a mentor in African American religion. And when I went on to start writing my PhD dissertation, I then decided that I want to do it on Islam in the United States in the 1920s. And you know, I had a really good dissertation director in Al Rabiteau. And that dissertation, I believe, laid the foundation for some of the work in soundtrack to a movement, because towards the end of my dissertation, which was, you know, I was looking at some African-American, Pan-African movements in the 1920s, like the Marcus Garvey Universal Negro Improvement Association, and its relationship to some, you know, some African-American, early African-American Muslim communities in the 1920s, like the Moorish Science Temple of America, which, you know, had already been studied a bit by C. Eric Lincoln in his classic study, Black Muslims in America. But towards the end of the writing of the dissertation, I was told by my advisors that I had one of the final chapters that needed a lot of extra work and a lot of extra research. So it's just very, very lucky that, you know, as a high school teacher at that time, during my last 2 years of writing my dissertation, I was a full time high school history teacher. So I told my principal that actually I need a week off because I need to go to the New York Public Library and do research. So I got that week off. And it was at New York Public Library that I found there were complete issues of journals published by the Ahmadiyya Muslim community from the 1920s to the present time. And when I went into those journals, I saw pictures of African-American converts to the Ahmadiyya Muslim community in the 1920s. There were stories about them. A number of them had been members of the Marcus Garvey Universal Negro Improvement Association. And so a chapter on the Ahmadiyya Muslim community and its links to African-American converts in the 1920s was a major contribution of my, you know, my PhD dissertation. And of course, that was that Ahmadiyya Muslim community link is a key to soundtrack to a movement, because I have a lot of information in soundtrack to a movement about the jazz musicians and Dizzy Gillespie's big band, African American musicians who were converting to the Ahmadiyya Muslim community in the 1940s and the 1950s. So that's kind of the beginnings of my, you know, my background as a scholar.
Terrific. So I was thinking, Richard, perhaps we can begin for those of our listeners who may not be familiar yet with the book, and that's one of the main aspirations of this podcast, to, you know, make them familiar and encourage them then to get the book, to do more close readings. I thought maybe it might be useful to begin with the title of the book, Soundtrack to a Movement, because that, I think, really nicely captures the key theme of this book, the intersection of jazz, African-American Islam, and a certain kind of, if I might put it, you know, a black politics that you're trying to capture in this book. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about how the title connects with the key theme and argument that you pursue in this book, to give a broad sort of overview of the theme and argument through the title.
Well, you know, my editors at New York University Press, after I had finished the book and the book was in press, they pulled this title from, you know, from a chapter in the book, Soundtrack to a Movement, and I agree that it's a very compelling title that is linked to my major argument in the book, because, you know, the book argues that from the late 1940s through the 1970s, Islam rose in prominence among Black Americans, in part because of the embrace of the religion of jazz musicians who were, you know, influential in creating a new kind of soundtrack that had religious and political dimensions. Some of these jazz musicians, like Art Blakey, Ahmad Jamal, Max Roach, Abby Lincoln, Etta James, and McCoy Tyner, converted to Islam, while others, like John Coltrane, Duke Ellington, and Dizzy Gillespie, who never officially converted, were intrigued and impacted by the religion and its philosophies, and were influenced by its musical culture. Soundtrack to a Movement asserts that Islam and jazz share common values, Black affirmation, freedom, and self-determination, which were key to the growth of Islam and African-American communities, and that it was jazz musicians, among others, who led the way in shaping encounters with Islam in the post-World War II period, as they developed a Black Atlantic coup. Also, I show in the book that Malcolm X had a great appreciation for jazz, having immersed himself in this musical tradition in Boston in the 1940s, as well as in New York City. And as a teenager, he danced the Lindy Hop in Boston's Roseland Ballroom, and especially appreciated the work of Duke Ellington and Billie Holiday, who was a personal friend of his. And so the book, you know, looks at the religious and political landscape and of jazz, and you know, the soundtrack of a movement, the ways in which jazz was linked to Pan-Africanism, the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement from the 1940s to the 1970s. And then actually the, you know, the hook for this soundtrack that weaves in and out of the different chapters of the book is the linkage between Malcolm X and John Coltrane. Because, you know, I start out with Malcolm X's relationships to the jazz community as a teenager. And then, you know, later on in the 1950s, after he has unfortunately served time in Massachusetts prisons, and he has been released from prison in the early 1950s, and you know, he joined the Nation of Islam while he was incarcerated. I also tell the story of how he began to do missionary work for the Nation of Islam in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, a number of major American cities. And then he was reaching out to jazz musicians for converts. Later on in the book, I talk about John Coltrane's, you know, soundtrack, which was based on sounds from Muslim majority countries, sounds from India, actually sounds from across the third world that he incorporated in his music. And I also talk about John Coltrane's life in Philadelphia in the 1940s and early 50s when he was married to Naima, his first wife, and she was a practicing Muslim. And just a little bit about his story at that particular time, because he was a very, very talented musician in the 1940s and 50s. Unfortunately, like a number of musicians in that period of time, he got addicted to alcohol and he got addicted to heroin. And his addictions caused Miles Davis, you know, the great trumpeter, to fire Coltrane from his band. And then, you know, living in a household that was run by a Muslim woman, John Coltrane got off of drugs cold turkey in a very, very short period of time. And, you know, and when he was released from his drug addiction with his wife's help, he believed that God had spoken to him and that when he was playing, he was praying. And then a little later on in the book, I bring Coltrane back into the story, because in the 1960s, of course, he composed the great album A Love Supreme that was very much influenced by his interactions with Muslim musicians in his band. It was very much influenced by the spirituality of Islam. You can hear that in the music. You can hear that in the prayers that he wrote, it's a kind of spiritual poetry that's on the liner notes of A Love Supreme. But right around the same time that he was composing A Love Supreme, John Coltrane was also going to Malcolm X's speeches anytime that he could when Malcolm X was speaking in New York City. And although Coltrane never converted to Islam, He did say in a number of interviews that he definitely had thought about converting it to Islam, particularly in Philadelphia, but he just never got around to it. So I make this argument for this this linkage between the soundtrack of Coltrane's music that reflected the Pan-Africanism, the internationalism of the civil rights movement and the Black Power movements in the 1960s, with Malcolm X's ideas about Black internationalism, especially when he left the Nation of Islam and made the Hajj to Mecca and converted to Sunni Islam and developed a human rights organization, the Organization of Afro-American Unity. And also, I link together in this chapter the scholarship on Coltrane and Malcolm X. I link that to observations by various jazz musicians, from Miles Davis to Archie Shepp, who believe that if what Coltrane was playing reflected what Malcolm X was saying about the third world and about the religion of Islam in his speeches. And at the same time, both of them said that they believed if Malcolm X had been a musician, he probably would have played like John Coltrane. So, you know, that's one of the stories in the book. But then there are a lot of other fascinating stories about jazz musicians who embraced Islam themselves, converted to the religion, and expressed their spirituality through their music. People like Yusuf Lateef, who converted to the Ahmadiyya Muslim community in the 1940s, and on some of his early albums, such as Eastern Sounds, in the 1950s, he attempts to recreate the sounds from the Middle East in his music. And you see, on some of his album covers that he's wearing a kufi, and he's, the way that he presents himself visually on his album covers, he is very proud that he is Muslim, and he's presenting that to the musical world. Also, so many fascinating stories. I look at the iconic album by Max Roach and Abby Lincoln, who both converted to Sunni Islam, the We Insist Freedom Now Suite, which they created in the early 1960s. And that album is very much linked to the to some of the most heroic faces of the civil rights movement, the students who were sitting in, trying to desegregate restaurants in the American South. It's linked to the Freedom Riders, and Max Roach, he actually converted to Islam. He's one of the great jazz bebop drummers. He converted to Islam in Brooklyn when he was a teenager. He married Abby Lincoln, who he persuaded to convert to Islam. She had been a jazz singer before she met Max Roach, but she was kind of she was being cultivated to be a kind of a sex symbol as a nightclub singer. Max Roach persuaded her that she could really perform, politically charged music. And so we hear Abby Lincoln on the We Insist Freedom Now Suite, recreating the sounds of, with her voice of Black people who are enslaved in the United States, who are suffering, beatings and on plantations. And then another part of the album, she is reciting all of the various African nations that had emerged from colonialism in the 1950s. And she's doing this with the drum beat of Babatun Olatunji, who was a very famous Nigerian drummer at that particular point in time. I look at the story of Etta James, a rhythm and blues and jazz musician in the 1950s and 1960s, who converted, first of all, to the Nation of Islam. She had a very friendly relationship with Malcolm X, who was shaping her spirituality. And a little known story about Etta James: after she converted to the Nation of Islam, she had some early contacts with Muhammad Ali, who at that point in time, and I guess this would be the early 1960s, had not converted to the Nation of Islam. He was still known as Cassius Clay. And so she's one of the first people who tried to convert Cassius Clay to the Nation of Islam. you know, her story is very fascinating because eventually she left the Nation of Islam, where she had changed her name to Jane Seta X, and she converted to the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. So these are just a few of the very fascinating stories that I tell in this book.
Wonderful.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, the setting of the book is major cities of the Northeast, and especially Boston. And the first part of the book spend a lot of time sort of charting the social political landscape of the Northeast in this time period, sort of from the interwar period onwards, that made that a particularly fertile place for this kind of, you know, intersection of jazz, Islam, and liberationist politics. So I was wondering if you could just say briefly a bit about that landscape, that historical moment and context that in which you situate the larger sort of movement that you describe in the later parts of the book.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. I start the book off in Boston because, you know, Boston in 1940 is where Malcolm X escaped to. You know, he came from a family of militant Pan-Africanists. They were organizers, his mother and father, for Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, which was an anti-colonialist movement in the 1920s. You know, it promoted pride in blackness and, you know, linkages to the to Africa. You know, a very revolutionary movement in its time, and its motto was "Up, you mighty race! You can accomplish what you will." And unfortunately, Malcolm X's father, who was also a Baptist preacher, was murdered by white supremacists in Michigan because he was an organizer for the Universal Negro Improvement Association and wouldn't back down from his politics. So in 1940, young Malcolm X, he's about 15 years old. He moved from Michigan to live with his half sister Ella Collins in Boston, Massachusetts. And it was in Boston that Malcolm X had his first very deep interactions with the jazz communities. Also, at the same time, Malcolm X had this continuation of the Marcus Garvey Universal Negro Improvement Association in his Boston family, because his sister Ella Collins had married a member of the UNIA who was Afro-Caribbean. He was a doctor in Boston, and so I also show that Malcolm X had linked himself in the jazz clubs to Malcolm Shorty Jarvis, who was a young professional musician who played with bands like Duke Ellington when he sat in with them when they came through Boston. And it's very interesting that it was in Boston where both Malcolm X and Malcolm Shorty Jarvis were first introduced to Islam. They were introduced to the religion by an Indian missionary from the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, who, you know, he was a very talented pianist, I guess classical pianist, and he lived in the same community that Malcolm X and Shorty Jarvis lived in, Roxbury, in the 1940s, and invited, first of all, Shorty Jarvis to his house to impress him with the way that he played the piano, and then he began tutoring Malcolm Shorty Jarvis on Islam. And eventually, Malcolm Shorty Jarvis invited Malcolm X to this missionary's home, and they both were learning about Islam. Unfortunately, all that got interrupted in the mid-1940s because both of them, you know, they were unfortunately involved in theft. They were arrested. They went to prison in Massachusetts, and that's where, you know, in the while they were incarcerated in Massachusetts, that both of them converted to the Nation of Islam. And then, of course, I shift the focus of the book to New York City, because New York City, of course, is the place where many of the great jazz musicians in the world lived, because that's, you know, that's where many of the great jazz clubs were. And it's also a place that is linked to Malcolm X's, you know, teenage years, because, you know, he very quickly, once he was in Boston on the East Coast, he began traveling to New York City. He was working for the, you know, the trains that ran between Boston and New York. He was working as a person who served sandwiches. And so there I shift to Harlem, of course, as this great Pan-African community on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And of course, that's where Marcus Garvey had its headquarters in the 1920s. It's the location of the Harlem Renaissance. And it's also the place where Duke Ellington lived. It's the place where W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the founders of the National Association for Advancement of Colored People, which was a great anti-lynching civil rights organization, he lived there during this period of time. And so New York City is one of the major urban sites throughout the book, because we find that John Coltrane, whose story is linked to Philadelphia, you know, I go there and show that there was a thriving jazz community in Philadelphia, and there was also a thriving African-American Islamic community in Philadelphia at the same time. And Coltrane moved to Philadelphia from North Carolina in the 1940s and lived there into the 1950s. But eventually he did move to New York City. Many of the, just about all of them, moved to New York City. So there are just so many fascinating stories of jazz musicians who were influenced by Islam, who lived in New York City. Art Blakey, the jazz convert to Islam, he converted to Ahmadiyya Muslim community. He lived in New York City. He founded the Jazz Messengers, which actually was initially a group of jazz musicians who had converted to Islam. You know, it had over the years many great jazz musicians in the group. They weren't all Muslims, but Art Blakey in his apartment in Manhattan was doing missionary work for the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, encouraging numerous jazz musicians to convert to to Islam in his apartment building. And Dizzy Gillespie, of course, is living in New York City. And then it was in New York City that many of the great big bands played their music. Duke Ellington was one of the great big band leaders there. But then there's a major shift in jazz in New York City in the 1940s from the big band music to bebop, which is, a different, more intellectually oriented form of jazz with a faster sound, a fascinating sound. And that had many linkages to African Americans who converted to Islam, that is bebop. And bebop was invented in New York City. Behind the scenes, different jazz musicians engaged in jam sessions after they played in the clubs. And primarily the book is focusing on these major East Coast cities and the soundtracks that came out of these cities that were linked to the ascendancy of Islam in African American communities in these same cities as well as across the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One theme that is a major theme of the book that you've already spoken quite a bit about, but I think it deserves more commentary, is the relationship of Malcolm X to jazz. And one of the things that you show really beautifully in the book is that that this is a relationship that continued at different stages of his life. Before going to prison, he would attend, jazz performances. And then you show that when he joined the Nation of Islam, that these very jazz spaces then became an important recruiting ground for him as well. So could you tell us a bit more about this very interesting relationship of jazz and Malcolm that I don't think has been explored in much depth before? And you do quite a fascinating job and fantastic job of that. So could you speak a bit about that theme?
Yes, jazz is very, very important for Malcolm X, particularly starting out in the World War II period, because he was a Zoot Suiter. And the Zoot Suiters were jazz fans. They were young people during World War II. They had a countercultural movement because they were wearing clothing that marked them out as dancers of the Lindy Hop and just a minute, I'm trying to get back. Okay, because if I don't touch my mouse on my computer, it kind of turns off at a certain point in time. Brain turns off. But anyway, the Zoot Suiters were really important during World War II because they were wearing this clothing, these long suit jackets, these hats with feathers in them. They were some of the greatest jazz dancers of the Lindy Hop. And during World War II, they were primarily African-American and Latino teenagers and young people. And unfortunately, the Zoot Suiters were marked out for persecution in different parts of the country. There were Zoot Suit riots and Los Angeles in the 1940s among, Mexican-American youth who were connoisseurs of jazz. They actually were beaten by U.S. service people in Southern California, beaten brutally. Their clothes were taken off of them in the streets. And but Malcolm X was a Zoot Suiter, and so that was very much a part of his youth, and it was a part of his it encouraged his resistance strategies to serving in the American military during World War II. And then, you know, when he got into prison, and unfortunately, you know, he was in there for a number of years in Massachusetts, and there he converted to the Nation of Islam because his brothers and sisters were sending him letters, and they were converting to the Nation of Islam themselves. Malcolm X, once he converted, you can see in his letters, he was trying to write letters to his friends in the jazz world to get them interested in Islam. You know, he was still in prison. He actually didn't have their home addresses, so he was sending letters to various jazz clubs and bars where he had hung out and had danced as a jazz band, hopefully to connect to some of his, you know, some of his comrades in the jazz world in the 1940s before he had been incarcerated. And then, you know, when he got out of prison and in the 1950s, you know, he lived with his brother in the Detroit area, and his brother was already a Nation of Islam minister. And eventually he became a minister for the Nation of Islam. And Elijah Muhammad saw that he had these, he had a fascinating speaking ability, because on the one hand, Malcolm X had re-educated himself in prison. He had taken all types of correspondent courses and foreign languages. And of course he had converted to Islam. So he was reading Islamic literature. He was reading many different types of books in the prison libraries in Massachusetts. And at the same time, Malcolm X knew how to speak the street lingo. So he was the perfect person to, you know, for Elijah Muhammad to send to various cities, from Boston to New York to Philadelphia, you know, to find new converts to the Nation of Islam who were young people who were still involved in going to jazz clubs. And Malcolm X was able to get a lot of youth converts, and a lot of it had to do with his, you know, not just with his spirituality, which was extremely important, and his intelligence and his, you know, his political background in the Universal Negro Improvement Association, Pan-Africanism, but he was also able to identify himself with, you know, with youth who were in jazz clubs and dancing and involved in different ways and, you know, the street life, who wanted to get out of that, you know, that cycle of drinking and drugs and, you know, very, very fast self-destructive activities. And, you know, the little known fact also is that the Nation of Islam, although it forbade, you know, drinking and, you know, drug consumption and dancing and, you know, going to clubs, the Nation of Islam sponsored many different, you know, bazaars and concerts that where they hired jazz musicians to play. I was really fascinated by that. There's a lot of evidence about that. So that I'm sure that Malcolm X had an impact on that, of you know, the Nation of Islam utilizing the soundtrack of jazz musicians to you know, to in their very street bazaars and their you know, their major events to recruit people to convert to their religious movement. So you know, jazz seemed to be a constant in Malcolm X's life, although of course you know, once he converted to Nation of Islam and also, you know, once he left the Nation of Islam and he became a Muslim imam, after he had made his Hajj and he had taken courses on Islam and Arabic at Al-Azhar University and became certified as a Sunni Muslim imam. Of course, he had to play down his linkages with the musical world, but those linkages were always there. And finally, you know, I don't have any evidence for this, but there is certainly very hard evidence that John Coltrane was going to Malcolm X's speeches in New York City anytime that he had a chance to, because Malcolm X's second wife, Alice Coltrane, has been interviewed and she has said that. I can't believe, although there's no hard evidence for this, that Malcolm X and John Coltrane did not meet one another at one point in time when Coltrane was attending Malcolm X's speeches, and he actually said that he was very impressed by the man. He was impressed by his message.
Now, the final question I want to ask you, Richard, has to do with what I would call sort of the last term in your the second part of your title, which is African American Islam, Jazz, and Black Internationalism. And you show in this book that this is not only a U.S. story, but rather many of these jazz artists and musicians and performers really also mobilized a very powerful language and symbols of a certain Black international politics that was current in, you know, what we today would call Global South societies and these third world political movements of the time. Could you speak about this aspect of your book a bit, the internationalist, the Black internationalist motif of jazz and Islam?
Well, you know, this is very, very important because there's been an international motif in African American culture, definitely since the 1920s with the Marcus Garvey Universal Negro Improvement Association, because that was a global Pan-African movement, and it had, and of course, Malcolm X was raised in that movement, and it had chapters in the United States, in Europe, in Africa. It was a global movement. But, you know, in my study, the term Black internationalism refers to a global Black religious consciousness and interconnected religious movements that led African Americans to think universally about their freedom struggles. As the middle of the 20th century approached, I tried to show that many African Americans began to see themselves in a larger global context as part of the worldwide liberation struggles of Blacks in the African diaspora and Africa, and also sometimes in solidarity with the oppositional struggles of people of color who were not Black. So there's an element, an aspect of my book where I talk about the U.S. government's, U.S. State Department's programs to send jazz musicians, and most of them were African American, to the third world to perform, beginning in the 1950s, and this continued into the 1960s. And here, you know, many of the famous jazz musicians, great jazz musicians, people like Dizzy Gillespie and Duke Ellington, were traveling to Muslim majority countries to perform in concerts in Senegal and Pakistan and Egypt and various places. And the U.S. State Department started this program, during the Cold War, because of course, the United States was facing a lot of criticism from the Soviet Union during the Cold War because of its Jim Crow policies, where you know, Blacks were continuing to be lynched in record numbers in the 1950s, and, you know, and Black people did not have civil rights in the United States during that decade. They were still legally segregated in, you know, in public spaces through the, you know, the Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court decision, which had mandated, you know, racial segregation in the United States in the 1890s. And so the United States believed that by sending these famous Black jazz musicians, not all of them were Black, but most of them were, to the Third World, that they could, you know, they could soften this very hard image of anti-Black racism in the U.S. because U.S. government officials in the State Department were very much aware that, you know, in a global context, their treatment of their Black citizens was being compared to apartheid in South Africa. And so this is a part of that Black internationalism that many famous jazz musicians utilize to reach out to, you know, to musicians, indigenous musicians in the Third World, because although the U.S. State Department had these, you know, they had programs that they wanted the jazz musicians to follow when they went to these various countries to perform. You can see the photographs, which I have examined at the Smithsonian Archives, of jazz musicians like Dizzy Gillespie, as well as Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, you know, branching out beyond the State Department, you know, program locations to meet indigenous musicians, to learn their, you know, their musical instruments, the instruments that people are playing on the streets in places like Pakistan and India. And there were exchanges between these jazz musicians about the liberation struggles that were going on in the United States, the civil rights liberation struggles, as well as, you know, the jazz musicians getting a sense of the anti-colonial struggles that were still going on in different parts of the Third World, or as well as in countries that, you know, particularly African countries that had recently emerged from colonialism and were, you know, were now independent nations. So this Black internationalism I see playing out in a big way in many musicians' soundtracks, particularly John Coltrane. He seems to have been the jazz musician who had many fascinating interactions with, you know, with Islam in his personal life, as well as with musicians who played in his band, who had internationalist, you know, religious affiliations. Because of course, you know, he played with McCoy Tyner, who was his pianist for many years. He was a pianist who played on A Love Supreme. And McCoy Tyner was from Philadelphia, had converted to the Ahmadiyya Muslim community when he was a teenager, and he was married to a Muslim woman himself. And, you know, in Coltrane's music, I argue that, you know, we are hearing a soundtrack from the Third World. Because, you know, if you listen to My Favorite Things, where Coltrane is playing the soprano saxophone, he has taken a Rodgers and Hammer, you know, song, popular music song, and he's giving it a kind of an Indian musical sound. And he's doing that on purpose. You know, in A Love Supreme, you certainly can, You can hear the Black internationalism in the music, because Yusef Lateef, who you know, there are a lot of great interviews now published, you know, with Yusef Lateef, who was one of the early converts to Islam among the great jazz musicians. He was a very, very close friend of John Coltrane, and particularly his first wife, who was Muslim, Naima. And Yusef Lateef makes the assertion that, you know, that John Coltrane was very much influenced by the spirituality of Islam when he composed A Love Supreme. And he basically is saying that when you're listening to A Love Supreme, and also when you are reading the prayer that John Coltrane writes, it's a very, very complex prayer about purification and transcendence. You know, he's making the case that John Coltrane was very much influenced by Islamic poetry, and you can hear that influence in A Love Supreme. And actually, there are a number of scholars who have argued, and they've argued that in the part of A Love Supreme, and this is the only album where you actually hear John Coltrane, you know, kind of speaking or chanting. There's an album where there's a part of the album where he's reciting with his musicians, A Love Supreme, A Love Supreme. A number of scholars have made the case, and of course they are Muslim, that Coltrane is actually reciting Allah Supreme, Allah Supreme, Allah Supreme. So there are so many instances of jazz musicians in this book who were very, very deeply influenced by Black internationalism. And finally, you know, Yusef Lateef in an interview tells us that actually in the last year of his life, Coltrane didn't know that he was going to die in 1967. He died very suddenly. That Coltrane had planned a series of concerts with Yusef Lateef and with Babatunde Olatunji, and they were going to play in Carnegie Hall. It had already been booked, and the music was going to focus on, you know, the music and the spirituality that came from the third world, and that actually Coltrane had already, you know, and this is just weeks before he passed away, he had already planned a trip to spend significant time in Africa with a Nigerian drummer, Babatunde Olatunji. And so I see very much in John Coltrane's music this Black internationalism. And you know, one of his last albums that he recorded is a concert in Japan, where, you know, Coltrane's band, they played a series of concerts in Japan. And it's very fascinating that when Coltrane landed in Japan, the first thing that he wanted to do was to go to the sites where the atomic bomb had been dropped in Japan, because he wanted to feel the spiritual vibes of the people who had suffered, who had been killed by the atomic bombing, and that the Americans had done during World War II. So there's quite a bit about this theme of Black internationalism in this book. And of course, Black internationalism is a major theme as the civil rights movement begins to evolve and into a Black power movement. in the late 1960s that is focusing on African Americans, linkages, politically and creatively, artistically, to the third world, and to particularly to Africa, but actually to anti-colonial struggles that are going on across the third world, that many African American political leaders and ordinary African Americans believed were parallel struggles to the civil rights struggles and the embrace of the Black Power movement by African Americans in the United States. And so this music, this soundtrack that jazz musicians produce that has these, that resonates with the significance of Islam in the African American community is a part of the zeitgeist of the African American struggle for freedom, particularly in the 1960s into the 1970s.
Soundtrack to a Movement, African American Islam, Jazz, and Black Internationalism by Professor Richard Brent Turner, published by New York University Press in 2021. Thank you so much, Richard, not only for writing this exquisite and important new book, but also for so generously and extensively sharing your thoughts about it. And I'm sure it will spur many listeners to pick this book, read it, learn from it, and teach it in various seminars, undergraduate and graduate. Thank you so much for your time today, Richard.
And thank you. It was a great pleasure to speak to you.
So this was my conversation with Professor Richard Brent Turner about his wonderful new book, Soundtrack to a Movement. I hope you enjoyed this conversation and this episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the NBN, the New Books Network. Please join us next time for another fresh episode of the New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to NBN.